Hey, this is post-production Matthew Marissa. Content warning for this episode includes a brief mention of self-harm. Listener discretion is advised. Thank you and enjoy the episode.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Haha, wasn't that a great episode last week where we talked about all those things relevant to 2023?
Yeah, that was an awesome episode that we did last week.
Yeah, it was so good and so timely, too.
Yeah, well, I think my favorite thing about the episode we did last week is that I remember everything that happened during it.
Yeah, and we only talked about recent events.
Yep, nothing like, you know, really late or anything. We are... They call us, aside from NetSurfer Pro, Whirlwind Ride Through the World Wide Web, with your co-host Galen.
And Matthew Marissa.
They also call us the most timely podcast in America.
Yeah, I didn't even have to cut anything out for being very untimely.
Yeah.
Which is rare.
So, this is part two of Disco Elysium, as you've probably gotten from the little bit at the beginning.
And from the title saying part two of Disco Elysium.
And from the fact that this is a two-part episode.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're unfortunately not going to have time for any of our silly goofs. We've got a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah, so we, like, barely got anywhere in the last one.
Now, in our defense, Disco Elysium is kind of this kind of game.
Yeah. It's a game that takes place in a very detailed city, and it is a city, and talking about it is like walking through a city. You're gonna get lost, you're gonna find a weird alley that has like a bug at the end of it, you're gonna get scared by the bug, you're gonna run out of the alley, someone's gonna ask if you're okay, you're gonna keep running because you're still afraid of the bug, you'll hide inside a McDonald's, and you'll like order a soda.
We've all been there before, of course.
Yep, yeah. So, just a quick recap for our sake, and for your sake, we definitely don't need a recap. we talked a lot about sort of the premise of the game, the mechanics of the game. We talked about some specific characters, and we talked a lot about how the game treats ideologies, especially fascism.
Yes. Fascism, my favorite topic to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Not my favorite topic, period. To talk about, specifically.
Yeah. So... We very briefly touched on sort of the main actual plot line of the game. We talked a lot about the mechanics, but there's two mechanics we didn't talk about that we should mention because they're interesting.
So, the two mechanics here are, well, let's start with the capo types first.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pieces of marketing of Disco Elysium is essentially... the core question at the heart of it is, what kind of cop are you? One, this works is honestly kind of a funny little thing, because this is something that you can very much ask of the protagonist of, what kind of cop are you? But this is also an intensely interesting thing to ask as a player, because, not to generalize, but I would assume that if you are playing this game and you are listening to this podcast, you are probably a leftist. And if you are a leftist, you probably know...
If you listen to NetSurfer Pro, you're probably a leftist.
If you... if your GPS tells you to make a right and you go on to make three lefts... Sorry.
You're probably suboptimal.
But this is an very interesting question, specifically where this comes from, because even if you don't want to be a cop, you are playing the role of cop in this game. I believe that I mentioned last time that, like, it's really interesting that the game brings up that even though you are a cop, the establishment doesn't like you. They see you as basically a problem that you know, constantly gets in their way. So there's a little bit of deniability there, but... It's really interesting that the game is like, okay, look, sit down, you are a cop, you have no say in this, so what kind of cop are you going to be? And there's a bunch of fun copo types.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's Apocalypse Cop, who is essentially the sort of, like, the end is near sort of, you know, trope of, like, a guy who's constantly talking about the end of the world. Which, you know, is a funny bit until you learn things about the world, which I don't know if we spoiled last time.
I don't think we did. The first episode was pretty spoiler light. We'll get into that in a bit.
Yes. But you also have things like, say, Sorry Cop, which you probably got on your first playthrough, calling you specifically out there, me, which is also very funny because you just constantly sort of have to apologize for existing.
Mm-hmm.
It's honestly such a great... it's such a great, like, skewer of criticism where it's like, you know... Assuming you're a leftist and you're playing this, you're probably kind of like constantly apologizing that you have this authority. And so the game just directly calls you out like, oh, I'm sorry. Did you not want to be a cop? Maybe you should have played a different game, nerd. You've got a job to do.
I find, by the way, the RCM very interesting.
Yes.
Because so the backstory for the RCM is that they're kind of put in place post-revolution in Revachol. Because if they weren't going to have their own police, then the international powers that be would put their own police in. And the Revachol, like, they didn't want other people ultimately policing them and deciding for them and, like, brandishing weapons. But also, like, the RCM is so under budget and it's only volunteer work. And, like, it feels like the people that work at the RCM, like, most of them care about making things better, but they're ultimately put into a system where they can't do that.
Yeah, it's like being a volunteer firefighter if you ultimately also had the ability to, like, fine people.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, there's people who then go on to abuse that power, as many do. But, like, it's a really interesting point where, like, we come into this game with preconceived notions about being a cop because we exist in this world.
Yeah.
And the game is close to this world in many ways, but very different in, you know, a lot of these specifics. And so it's sort of an interesting, like, little moral quandary of, like, you know, well, are the RCM inherently bad? You know, like, there is no such thing as a good cop in modern day, but is this type of policing as inherently, you know, exploitative and destructive?
Yeah, compare Kim to, like, the militia that the Wild Pines, like, pays and hires.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, if you come out on the other side and say that, no, this is still an inherently corrupt system, that's honestly itself a very legitimate, like, take to have.
Yeah.
Nothing is ever easy in Disco Elysium.
Mm-hmm.
So that's copotypes. That's only a couple. There's like, I think a total of five, including, like, Boring Cop and Superstar Cop, all of which are funny, but also very interesting, like, interesting little views into the use of police. But I'm going to say that if you're interested in that, play the game.
Yeah.
We have to move on. Disco Elysium has no addiction mechanic, and therefore it has an addiction mechanic. So this is a take that my roommate gave, and I'm going to specifically shout out my roommate, you know who you are if you're listening to this, which is that Disco Elysium has drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol allow you to retake skill checks if they are white. Drugs and alcohol will give you specific bonuses to skill checks, like, you know, having a certain type of alcohol might make you more persuasive, or doing speed might make you more perceptive, that sort of thing. And they do have little negatives, but realistically, if you just took one hit of speed in the entire game, there's no, like, you know, there's nothing that says, you know, oh, you have to do it now. Like, if you've invested into electrochemistry, sure, it'll constantly be like, hey, you should take this. But there's nothing that forces your hand. Drugs and alcohol are entirely positive in the game. Essentially, like, there is minor drawback, but they
short term hurt you,
but, like, long term, they usually, the benefits of doing it, especially if you're, like, playing in Iron Man mode, for example, and can't retry a check without investing a whole skill point, like, it's actually really, like, it's really good, like, a really good simple trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the beauty of it. That's the beauty of Disco Elysium's take on addiction, which is that realistically, in the moment, there are ways it hurts you, but, you know, there's also a lot of benefits to doing it. And so if you kind of have that mindset about it, you suddenly realize that you've done a whole lot of alcohol by the end and a whole lot of drugs by the end, and you suddenly realize, oh, Disco Elysium has an addiction mechanic.
Yeah, it's not really a mechanic, it's that it puts the addiction part in the hands of the player. to ultimately role play out the addiction.
Yeah.
Because they have created a situation where the drugs and alcohol give you, you know, it makes some things easier. It's like, it's a slight boost, but like you want to keep using them because it helped you in the moment, right?
Yeah.
And so while it doesn't have a stat that's like you are addicted, and ultimately, like, whether or not you realize it's addiction is up to you and your self-awareness, but like it makes the player, it gives the player the decision, and thus the impact of it is all on them mentally.
I also love, like, this is also this might be aping sort of a Reddit like post that somebody made, but I also love the fact that even if you are completely clean, everybody still treats you like a drunkard, because from everyone else's perspective, you've been sober for 3 days.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you as the player can be like, hey, I haven't taken a single drink, and, you know, like, you can get like Kim Kitsuragi to like admit that you haven't, but, you know, you're a character who has a massive history of this, who's definitely done this before, and, you know, like, has definitely said, like, yeah, I definitely quit this time, and has failed, like, pretty clearly. And so, and, like, that's also a really interesting perspective, especially, like, you know, I can imagine a lot of people who suffer from hard addictions seeing themselves in this game where, like, everyone around you is assuming that you're just going to go back, so the real question is, why don't you?
Yeah.
The last point I want to make here is a perspective that I did not think about until a video by Ovendahl. Ovendahl is a YouTuber who's made a lot of really interesting videos. Go check them out if you want to. But they made a video over how video games handle addiction, and they made the specific point of you get a quest early on that's like, take some smokes. And if you pick up a pack of cigarettes, then electrochemistry buzzes in and is like, hey, 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 you should smoke that. And if you say no, it has the line of, all right, that's fine, don't smoke it now, but don't worry, you have your whole life to go back to it. And in their case, they made the point of, they are an ex-smoker, and they made the point of, like, that was the first time that it dawned on me, oh, this craving's never gonna go away, is it? This is just kind of what my life is now, isn't it? And as somebody who, I will now bear a little bit of myself, I do weed pretty regularly. I would not say I am addicted personally, and this is also a no shade on anybody with addiction podcast. Addiction is an extremely complicated subject. If you are addicted to something, like, nuance. This is a podcast that is pro, you know, rehabilitation, and is not going to shame anybody for being addicted. But that was a really interesting moment for me as well, because that made me go, you know, whenever I don't have weed in hand, I do have a little voice that's sort of like, God, I wish I had some weed right now. And I don't think that is a problem right now, but I'm not going to say it's never going to be a problem. And that's something that I now have to live with, I suppose. And so, you know, like, again, I am a very low stakes example of this. I am not going to say that, you know, oh, I've also dealt with this, but that's a really interesting perspective to think about, considering that I am now somebody who pretty regularly does a certain type of drug.
The devil's lettuce.
The wacky tabacky.
Yeah, I think, like, the most the game really does to mechanize addiction is the pop-up windows of your stats telling you, like, hey, you should do this.
Yeah.
Which is still sort of a way of, like, trying to coerce the player into doing so. It's sort of an intrusive thought, literally, but, like, it's also a pop-up window that goes away if you do the thing.
Yeah. It's also one that you can say no to pretty regularly.
Yeah.
I also really like, one last sidebar, I really like that electrochemistry also has a lot of specific uses in-game as well as a cop. Like, you can look at somebody and tell that they are strung out on some kind of drug. And that's such an interesting perspective, too, where it's like, you know, like, because you are somebody who's gone through a lot of this and has done a lot of this, you are somebody who can recognize when somebody else is. And that's interesting. Okay, Those are the two really interesting mechanics, and this took 15 whole minutes.
Yeah.
Let's get into it.
Okay, so we talked about a lot of the big name players. There are a few big characters we need to talk about before we get into the resolution of the storyline. So first, I want to talk about Urvart.
Yes.
We briefly touched on him in the previous episode. If we did talk about him at length, I apologize. It's been a hot minute. I think Urvart's super interesting. The Union as a whole is really interesting because, like, that's another instance of it's playing off of the preconceptions of the audience, especially leftists, where you want to say Union good, and there's a lot of good stuff in the Union, but, like, there's also, it tries to take every chance it gets to cast doubts upon the Union's morality. The Hardy Boys, which we also briefly mentioned, are sort of one of the big ways this happens, but Urvart is really interesting because, like, you get into the docks, you're able to talk with him, he reveals that A, he knows where your gun is.
Yeah.
And B, he knows about you more than you know about yourself, and more than anyone else has been willing to tell you. And he has information, he just wants some cooperation. Do you remember what the actual, like, fetch quest is for him?
Yes, the first quest is to walk into, like, unlock a door. And he doesn't, he says, don't right. go into it, you can go into it. It turns out to be a room that a racist is staying in.
Yeah.
The third racist.
There's a great joke of, there's the cryptozoologist who, I just want to briefly mention, there's a cryptozoologist looking for a cryptid called the Insulindian Phasmid. You can help him out with setting up traps for it.
Yep.
And then also touring with the cryptozoologist is the crypto-fascist.
Yeah, which is such a perfect 1-2 punch.
Yeah, and the crypto-fascist is the guy who lives in that building.
Yes. But, so yeah, your first one is to unlock it. Your second one, I never did the second one, but he has you continuing to do fetch quests, which I believe ends up with him, like, basically coercing the people in the land across the bridge to sell their land.
Yeah.
Because he wants to, like, redevelop it.
He wants to build a rec center.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's another interesting part is, like, the development he proposes doesn't sound bad, but it is, like, removing people. But then he's like, I'll compensate them. I'll give them free lodging. They'll be able to make use of the facilities for free. Like, he has a plan that is supposed to help them, but it's like, is this helping them? Are they gonna be impoverished still?
Yeah.
There's a lot of doubts about Urvart's intentions. He is, like, he is a smooth talker. Before you even meet him, there's, like, this pamphlet you can read. It's the one that also mentions the communist F1 race
nice.
Criticism thing. The critics. But it's talking about how, like, some people think that Urvart and his brother Edgar, who are twins, are essentially, like, trading roles as the head of the Union, and they're coercing people to, like, stay on top so they can maintain power. And when you meet Urvart, I think it's all set up to, like, really make you think he's, like, abusing the position or making bank while the workers aren't. Yeah.
He is a Pete from Mickey Mouse, kind of, like, he is slimy,
sort of a kingpin.
Yeah, he has a literally, like, you know, really nasally, like, you know, oh, come now, Harry, you must, you know, fine, I guess you are my little pog champ.
Yeah.
But, like,
he's in, like, a red velvet chair. There's, like, a deer hanging on his wall.
Yeah, it is entirely set up to where you look at him and you go, oh, he's, you know, he's abusing his power. He's siphoning funds.
He's the epitome of the fat cat.
Yeah, he doesn't give a shit about any of those below him. He's just in there to benefit himself and no one else. And then everything you do for him is really kind of just to help the town.
He's like, yeah, it's like unlocking the door for the crypto fascist means that the crypto fascist is less fascist, or he's not so emboldened to be fascist. There's bits where, like, you learn that he's essentially employing people who would otherwise be unemployed.
Yeah.
Like, there's a guy named Leo, I believe, who sits right outside Urvart's office, which is, by the way, in a shipping container.
Yeah.
And Leo's just like, Well, I just kind of sit here and keep an eye out for anybody coming around. And it seems like Leo is disabled in some way.
Yeah.
But, like, Ervart pays him because he knows Leo doesn't have anything else to help him.
Yeah.
And so he just gives him a job to sit around. Even when they're on strike, he still gets money because he needs the money. And, like, Ervart understands that and everyone else does. And then there's another character named Renee who is a, like, ex-military.
Yeah.
And Renee's kind of... also fascist in the xenophobic sense.
He is ex-military.
He's nationalist.
Yeah, he's a nationalist. He actually does show up to like the fascist meeting if you go down the fascist path.
Yeah.
But like he is a xenophobic nationalist, but he's also really interesting because like he is part of the army that lost, basically.
Yeah.
And so like he's constantly pining for the old days.
Yeah. And but like Ervart hires him as a security guard because the veterans benefits are non-existent.
Yeah.
And so there's this interesting bit of like Ervart kind of does actually care about the people. And then like, you know, you mentioned like, well, aren't you and your brother just trading places? And he's like, well, actually, they are voting for us because they prefer our organization, you know? The union is only by vote.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's really interesting where it's much like how the RCM is painted to be bad cops, you know, ACAB, but then, like, they're just hobbling together with sticks and twine.
Yeah. Everett Everett in the union is painted to be sort of, like, this parasitic force. And, like... to be clear, part of the storyline that you uncover that's not part of the murder is that they are actually, like, controlling the drug trade.
Yeah.
And he sort of, like, uses the excuse of, like, you know, well, would you rather it be us or would be, you know, some other force? And, like, it's you know, it's very morally gray where it hands you on a silver platter this cut and dry, these are bad people. Even if you believe unions are good, this is a bad union. And then immediately twists it and it's like, actually, no, this, he kind of does seem to really have the best interest of Revachol at heart.
It's weird. So that's Ervart. There's Jody, who is the ultra-liberalist.
Yes.
Joyce. Sorry. Joyce, I have her Jody in my notes, but I looked it up before this and it forgot to change it that it's Joyce.
Right. It's
Joyce like Messier. Joyce,
yeah, Joyce Messier.
She is the, not ambassador, but the like...
representative?
Diplomat, sort of, for the Wild Pines. She is there to make the docks not be closed anymore. Stop having them not be open. And she's really interesting because, like, she's kind of fed up with shit. Her sort of position is that, like, she doesn't want to die, and so she does things to make money so that she can live.
Yeah.
It's interesting. She's, like, she is upper class, and she comes from upper class. Her family owned a vacation home in Old Revachol.
She's so interesting too. She is one of the few people. Well, one, she is actually the person that you go to get a lowdown on reality.
Yeah, she actually will explain things to you.
Yes, and two, she is not just that. She is like one of the most personable people you meet. So many other people immediately curse you out and mm-hmm. like immediately throw a bunch of shit your way, and that's. Fair,
yeah.
Given the history that you then, you know, find out, but like it's so goddamn funny to me that like Joyce, who is by all rights, like, you know, the representative for like the stuck up capitalist, you know, profit at no cost, like she is funny and nice, and like she's one of the few people you can actually get money from. And the funny thing too is like if you just one of the ways you do it, like if you get the successful role, literally it's just like just shout it, just fucking shout it. And so she immediately like laughs and is like, how much money? And you're like 120 real. Yeah, she is so like, but she's also, you know, the messenger man for this inherently really corrupt and exploitative system.
She is still just trying to steamroll the union for the sake of money and profit. She is cynical, and she's the type of person who tells you that she's cynical and that she's putting on a front in an attempt to sort of be relatable. And she's really well written, obviously. It's another instance of the game messing with your preconceptions. the person who is like the hyper capitalist is very personable and honest and down to earth, but also like kind of aloof still.
Yeah.
She's super interesting in that regard. Her position in the story is essentially she is the new negotiator. That's the word.
Yeah.
The old negotiator who was working with Wild Pines was fired. And there's some whispers that they may have been paid off by the Claire brothers, but it's never confirmed, I don't think. And she wants to reach an amenable, like, agreement, but the murder that happened is putting a big pin in that.
Yeah.
And it seems, sometimes it feels like she feels she is being, like, her authority is being superseded. Like, people are kind of working around her and above her, despite her role being a negotiator.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I want at this time to talk about the Pale.
Yes.
Because Joyce, she tells you about what the Pale is. She gives you the lowdown on reality. This is one of the coolest parts of the game. Spoilers from here on out for the rest of the game.
Yes. This is full spoilers. Just, you know, go play the game.
Yeah.
Holy crap. It's so good. Okay.
So up until now, you've been in a coastal city in Revachol. People talk about other countries and other continents, and it all seems pretty normal.
Yeah.
You talk to Joyce. Oh, but there are mentions of the Pale, and it's not really clear what the Pale is. It sounds like it's something related to death, or it's a fungus. You know, there's a book early on in the bookstore called, like, The Medicinal Properties of the Pale.
Yeah.
But then there's, like, somebody who's been pale touched or something like that that you meet.
I want to specifically zoom in on the thought system here, because after you get the lowdown on reality, there's a thought that you get that's like the wild white yonder. And it literally is just like, there's something you're missing that's integral, but you're not sure what it is.
Yeah.
And you get the thought, you complete it, and it's ask her about the Pale.
Yeah.
And so you get the explanation on what the Pale is. The Pale is a gigantic, like, almost sort of primordial force, sort
sea,
of.
Sort of?
Yeah. It is essentially, imagine a giant wall that walls off large swaths of the world. Like, of Elysium.
Mm-hmm.
And there are habitable spots that, like, you know, are like, much like where you're at, like Revachol. But like the space between those habitable spots is essentially just a giant wasteland of like hyper radioactive question mark.
It's like radioactive, fungal, spectral.
Yeah, it's definitely also vaguely supernatural. Mm-hmm. And like kind of, you know, there's it does something to like memory and stuff.
Yeah, Joyce does not sleep because of the Pale.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interesting sort of hints at like the Pale doing weird fucked up things to the people who go through it. And Joyce being a negotiator who travels a lot has to constantly go through the Pale.
Yeah. Yeah. She like when you ask about it, she kind of like really grimly smiles and she's like, oh, I'm up to my gills in radiation.
Yeah.
Like I'm a ticking time bomb of death.
And I love it because for most of the game, it's just not really present, but they're in the background that you can see the Pale far off in the distance.
Yes, yes. And this is, oh, it's so, okay, it's so good on so many levels. I'm going to try not to gush super hard, but to go through it, one, climate change, perfect allegory. It's the deep underlying thing that's going to kill us all that nobody ever really thinks about. Two, Apocalypse Cop. The specific reason I bring Apocalypse Cop up is because it's funny to do it. Like, it's funny to be, you know, oh, the world's gonna end. And then you realize that the Pale is a thing, and you realize, oh, wait, no. No, actually, why isn't everybody constantly scared about this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why aren't we constant? Like, why haven't we dropped every other thing and I'm trying to solve this?
Yeah.
Three, it's also just super cool world building. Like,
yeah.
On its own, it's such a cool fucking thing.
Yeah, it's very different.
Yeah.
It's like kind of like the Shimmer, but also it's its own thing. It's really cool. I love like weird extra zones
yeah.
in world building in fiction, like the Shimmer. So that brings me to a side quest that's really crucial to the game.
Yes.
Because it includes the title drop of the game.
Yes.
Okay, so we need to talk about the nightclub.
The nightclub.
So across the bay, over in the sort of other side over the bridge, there is a group of punks, who are kind of making meth.
Yeah.
But they also want to start a nightclub. They like music.
They want to start a nightclub and also a drug lab. And
you can prevent them from doing either. You can encourage the nightclub but prevent them from doing the drug lab, or you can just be all in on it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good little character building moment. Presumably you're probably going to, if you're anything like us, you're going to be like, okay, do the nightclub, don't do the meth.
Yeah.
But as long as you have the nightclub, you now have forward progress.
Yeah, they're very cool. I love all of them. There's a guy named Egghead,
yeah,
who is notable because he just goes, hardcore!
Hardcore!
He has what is called, like, a dialogue maze.
Yeah.
Where there's no way of knowing what the correct response is. You just have to, like, try out responses.
You have to brute force it, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you can't sound like a poser. You'll be like, oh, this is hardcore, and then he's like, is it?
Yeah.
And then, like, if you say, like, it is, then he's like, oh, never mind.
Yeah.
And you have to start over. It's great. So the other teens, they're all fans of this one, like, techno artist, and it's pretty heavily implied that Egghead is that artist.
Yeah.
He, like, he asks you to go find a demo of the artist. It is just, like, he's the one who knows where it is. It's great. I love the trope of, like, well-meaning punks who are like, yeah, I actually love creativity and shit.
Yeah.
If you've ever watched Ted Lasso, the hooligans in Ted Lasso at the pub are very similar, where it's like they act like tough, oi, like idiots, but then they like start talking about their feelings.
Yeah.
It's great.
Soft punks are some of my favorite little like bait and switches.
Yeah, they're like Kuno, but not as far gone as Kuno.
Yeah,
in that they clearly need a escape and like an outlet. That you find them in a tent next to an old Dolorosian church, and you can help them get into the church, and they're like, this is a great spot for a nightclub. And I love it because like the sort of drive of that storyline is that the youth need a place for themselves. They need a scene. Like Revachol and Martinez especially are so suffocating. They're not places for teens to express themselves.
Yeah.
You meet one other young person trying to do that, who's like a wannabe communist who is trying to look cool so she can join the communist club.
Yeah.
And she's like a graffiti artist.
I love her. I love, yeah, Cindy the Skull. She's so wonderful.
Yeah. She is trying so hard, but not saying much with her art. But, like, the drive to start the nightclub is ultimately just, like, we need a place to ourselves where we can express ourselves without the pressure and fear from everyone else.
This also has the dancing scene,
mm-hmm,
which is, unfortunately, I've not actually done.
Me neither.
I desperately need to. My same roommate has said that it is basically, like, the best scene in the game. Also, here's another fun fact. It's one of the few references to the novel that this is based off of.
Mm.
Actually, to talk about that, we should talk about the whole.
Yeah, so, okay. Two things. I just want to say, this is where the name drop of the game is. One of the possible names for the nightclub you can suggest is Disco Elysium.
And you better believe that that's what you should suggest.
Yeah, it's because, like, disco as an ideal is very central to the game's themes.
Yeah.
I think we talked about it last time, that like disco is dead and represents a certain era of culture.
Yeah.
One where cops were action heroes. And the player character holding on to disco so long is a sort of in denial of the present, clinging to nostalgia as an escape to somewhere better than the present.
Yeah.
And the Disco Elysium, you know, it's the disco area of the world Elysium. It's also just a haven from everything else that has disco as its core identity.
Yeah, it's disco. Disco is kind of a really interesting like take on nostalgia and sort of like, you know, like you said, clinging onto the past. And I feel like in the nightclub sense, it's sort of a message of like, you know, it is bad to cling on to the past, but it is good to make a, you know, safe space for, like, for, you know, people to just sort of chill and vibe out. And that's sort of, that's a really good take on, like, you know, nostalgia is good sometimes when it, you know, helps people find comfort.
Yeah. Okay, so in the meanwhile, there is one spot in the church that is completely silent. Like, completely silent.
Yeah.
To talk about this, we have to talk about Suna. This is one of my favorite other parts to this.
It's so good.
So there's this business building full of, like, different floors and offices that is behind the bookstore, connected to the bookstore. There's somebody in there who makes custom dice for RPGs, which is really fun.
Yeah.
You can get a die and it's magic. But there's also an old, like, video game studio where they made essentially an ARG in the sense that it's like Inquest or The Beast, where, like, people call in from payphones to, like, interface with the game. It had this LARPing element based off a different RPG system in universe. But also, again, it was done via, like, calling in through phones and playing, like, as if it were a real thing.
Yeah, it's like, it's essentially, we would consider it an ARG, but in the context of the game, it kind of seems essentially just like somebody tried to make a normal, like, Bethesda game, but, like, in this world of, you know, where, yeah, like, shortwave radio is the most complex technology we have. Yeah,
or, like, it's sort of like a BBS RPG.
Yeah.
And the employees were essentially dungeon masters who you would call to and talk to.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bits in the story of how, like, they had all these funders, but they couldn't get the project going. And it feels very meta in a way for game developers to talk about game dev this way.
It's, yeah.
As,
it's,
like, a thing that happens, but then it kind of fails to happen.
One of the best bits is that it had this system of, like, talking heads where you could put certain talking heads on top of other bodies, and it's a super not thinly veiled reference to the thought system, because the thought system, according to developers, is basically what almost killed this game.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's, you can sense the, like, literal internal frustration, but it's also, like, very funny. Like, it's an expression of pain, but in a very funny way.
So, but what happened to this was that they had a significant data loss where, like, a ton of their data just disappeared.
Yeah.
And they couldn't do anything about it, so they packed up. Except for one person, Suna, who was one of the programmers on the game, and she is trying to figure out what the hell happened.
Yeah.
So you find her in the building, working alone. You help her out by getting a data core from an ice cream machine, which is the check I had the most trouble with in the game, but damn it, I needed to get that.
Yeah.
That, like, hard drive. And she pinpoints the location of the hole to the church.
Yes.
So she has some words upon learning that there's a nightclub going in, but they agree to share the space, at least until she's done. They won't start the nightclub operations.
Yeah, and then you can essentially specifically then help out without that, which is where the word hardcore puzzle comes in, the speech tree puzzle. But you hook up the amps to, like, the speakers and stuff,
mm-hmm,
and you record the hole, and it sounds like the Pail.
Yeah,
it's like this deep warbling, like, it is literally a Pail, like, emission transmitter or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, it's like, it, everybody has to, like, cover their ears, and it's kind of horrible, but, like, weirdly, you know, beautiful in its own way. And eventually I think Egghead literally unplugs it.
Yeah. It's like feedback at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, because that sort of implies that maybe this is how the Pail starts.
Yeah, maybe the Pail is growing from just a spot, and that brings even more context to the Apocalypse Cop. Like, wait a minute, is Martinez actually going to die? Is Revachol going to get swallowed by the Pail?
So here's the fun thing.
Yeah.
In the book, there is a check. It's like a really hard check. It's a random one-off thing. I think it is a Shivers check.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the specifics about this, but while you are dancing, you can listen to the city. And if you succeed, the city asks you to help it. And you can be like, why? And it says, I'm going to die. Because the book that this setting is based off of, I believe, kicks off, or one of the first plot points, is that Revachol gets nuked. So put that in your sippy cup and suck it dry. All your shit was for naught. Yeah, this is... You do not need this context at all. And indeed, like, it's one of the very actually few references to that book. But boy, does that just, like, add kind of another fucking layer to it.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit. The city is going to die, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not even beyond the pale. Like, this is before in the timeline we know how this one ends.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how many disasters are on the horizon.
Yeah.
There's the prospect of just, like, the civil war of, like, the militia people firing their guns into crowds.
Yeah.
There's the war of that already happened, that could happen again if the Union continues to shut down the docks. There's, you know, there's the Pale coming along. There's the possibility of a nuke. There's the People's Pile causing radiation everywhere. Like, everything is just fucked.
Oh, it's so...
It's so fucked.
It's so good.
It's so fucked.
It's so fucked and it's so good.
I love that. So, but that's all backstory. We need to talk about the night of the murder.
Yes. Okay, yes. So let's talk about the murder.
Yes. So...
Or at least what happened.
Yeah, so... The warrior, the militia guy who died, was seeing Clausia, who is your next door neighbor in the Whirling in Rags.
She's the first person you can talk to.
Yes.
And in typical Disco Elysium fashion, she is one of the most important characters in the game.
Yeah. She is an ex-spy. By the way, I said this is full spoilers.
Yes.
She is an ex-spy. Who is sort of in hiding in witness protection, going under a new identity.
She is in hiding because she did, basically, she did, like, corporate espionage.
Yeah.
And, like, corporate espionage is the kind of thing where, you know, a company can then hire goons to come and kill you because that's this kind of world.
Yeah.
And so she is basically just in hiding from that. And the goon, the guy, basically was just... Like, he was there because of the Union situation, but him and her just kind of hit it off.
Yeah.
And they ended up, yeah, seeing each other. They ended up, you know, having sex. Full spoilers, by the way.
Yeah. They fucked.
They fucked.
Spoiler alert, they fucked. And then the guy got shot.
And then the guy got shot. Well, actually, yeah. Then the guy got shot. We mentioned before that this is a hanging, I believe, in the previous episode. Turns out it's not. One of the earliest things you can do to figure out that it wasn't actually a hanging is if you pass a pretty decently high perception check, you can dig into his brain and find the bullet.
Yeah.
And find out that, no, this wasn't a hanging at all.
Yeah. He died while he was in Clausia's sort of apartment suite. Which was on the roof, by the way. It's a rooftop suite.
Yeah.
And who was there to help but the Hardy Boys?
The Hardy Boys, and specifically Ruby.
Yeah. So Ruby is a member of the Hardy Boys, quote unquote. She is sort of the leader in some regards. She is part of the drug smuggling ring, and she helped cover up this death because she was worried about Clausia getting caught.
Yeah. So Clausia's turn of events is that, like, the shot happened, she didn't know what to do, she went downstairs, like, Ruby came to her, and, like, Ruby seemingly kind of immediately knew what to do. So, like, Ruby comes up with her, Ruby suggests that they, like, hang him from her, like, shower head, so lividity kind of, like, drains, basically. And then she goes and gets the Hardy Boys to help him, like, to help hang him up. And then what happens is sort of, like, they make this really, like, loud ruckus about it. They hang him up, and then they just kind of all quietly leave.
Yeah.
So, like, they essentially, what you learn is that this was a staged political hanging, where the guy was already dead, but because of extenuating circumstances, they basically were like, well, we can kind of pretend this was, like, a political thing, you know?
Yeah. So there's something really interesting. So Hardy and the boys, they are like mob goons.
Yeah.
But their bit is that, again, they kind of care about the people of Revachol, of Martinez. Like, essentially, they exist as another form of militia because the RCM doesn't really care about Martinez.
Yeah.
Martinez is such a, like, not really backwater, but just such an impoverished area of Revachol that they needed some form of community policing to make sure people were safe overall.
Yeah.
And that's what the Hardy Boys are. Obviously, they're part of the Union, though Ervart denies any knowledge of their actions.
Yeah, it's a game of cat and mouse that exists in real life, where it's like, you know, oh, you know, they're, you know, they are independent citizens and I'm in charge, but I can't police their actions. It's that kind of like, you know, little game of like, I'm technically not responsible because they're acting as independent people, but, you know, it certainly does benefit us all.
Yeah. I really disliked Hardy as a person through most of the game, because, like, he's kind of an ass to you, and he makes the investigation very difficult on purpose. And, like, but, like, by the time it's, like, he was doing that to help out Clausia, who was kind of a victim of circumstance at this point. He cares about the people. Okay, so that's what happens during the night of the murder. I if you have anything else to say, you can go ahead, but I want to keep talking about the murder.
Go ahead.
Okay, so, for one thing, the stat tied to, like, visualization, like, visual thinking.
Yeah, visual calculus.
Visual calculus is really cool, because it will show, like, blueprint style flashbacks of the events taking place, and you can use that to pinpoint where the bullet came from when you're on the roof.
Yeah,
you, like, draw a path from, like, the bloodstains and the shattered glass on the window.
Yeah, there's, like, there's three specific paths that would actually work based on a map,
and one of them is an island across the bay, but in the bay, not the area across the bay.
Yeah.
And this all leads to eventually going to this island, which was an old war fort.
Yes. So this is the actual murder, right?
Yeah.
So here's the important thing, too, is that one of the biggest bottlenecks, I think basically the bottleneck that gets you into the end game, is that you need to convince Hardy to tell you where
Ruby is. Yeah.
And, like, eventually you basically just have enough evidence and you're just like, look, Ruby probably did this murder. Like, Ruby is suspect number one. And once he can finally just not deny it at all anymore, he will give you what you need to go to where Ruby is, which is, like, this underground.
It's like an old, they had, like, tunnels during the war where they would bring weapons through and stuff like that. And it was a tunnel underneath an electronics factory.
Yeah. So you go to where Ruby is, and this is what triggers endgame. If you want to do other things, don't go to Ruby before this. Obviously, we've already said this is spoilers, but, like, if you're still listening in and you personally want to play it, there is no time limit until you hit Ruby.
Yeah.
When you hit Ruby, she, like, actually puts you in a pale transmitter, like a pale emissions transmitter. And so you and Kim are, like, kind of stuck clutching at your ears, but you can still question her.
Mm-hmm.
And she, really interestingly, counters a lot of what Clausia said. So, for example, when Clausia said that Ruby was the one who, like, hung up the guy to, you know, get the lividity, according to her events, Clausia was actually the one who did it, and based off of, I will say, based off of, like, the gut instinct sort of responses you get, a lot of what your visual calculus says and things like that, you can kind of tell that Ruby is probably the more, like, not sympathetic, but, like, the one who is telling the more correct truth.
She's the one that's more honest, or the more believable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, it turns out that, like, Clausia was really one of the one, like, seemingly was really the one who kind of orchestrated it, or at the very least was the one who, like, did a lot of the wet work that she sort of pinned on Ruby. And Ruby, you know, explains a number of other things. A lot of them are more minor. You can knock over the pale emitter, or I think you pass out. But, like, once you have cornered her, she basically And we have trigger warnings here for a reason, but she turns the gun on herself and you have one chance to basically tell her, like, your options are either she dies or you basically tell her, like, just get out of here, leave. Like, we're not going to arrest you. You're fine. And so whatever happens, once you get back up and go to the Hardy Boys, like go to the Whirling in Rags, this is where the tribunal happens.
Yeah. The militia is now essentially holding a tribunal to try to find the person accountable for the lynching, and they will shoot.
Yes. There are three of them. There is the guy who, I don't even know if we mentioned him in last episode.
We did.
Okay.
The leader of the scabs.
Yeah, the leader of the scabs.
Who is very clearly a plant.
This, like, sniper guy who is, like, an asshole racist, basically. Mm-hmm. And then this woman who I don't remember if she's actually...
I feel like you meet her, like, once, but I don't remember where.
Yeah, I don't know if she's actually part of anything else.
Yeah.
But there's three of them, and then there's the Hardy Boys. This is a really, really good scene. It's really interesting because it's one of those things where a lot of the little choices essentially add up to an outcome of some kind.
Yeah.
I believe if looking into the game code to treat it like just code for a second, I believe essentially six people will die no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
The outcome is realistically more whether the people that die are the people on the other side, the people on the guard side, or the people on the Hardy Boys side. At least like three of them die no matter what, which is very unfortunate, but also, yeah, you know, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally kind of got the worst ending.
Mm-hmm.
I had no gun.
Mm-hmm.
Which, another thing. There are actually two ways to get a gun in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly two. There's do your bid, the bidding of Everart, and he will actually give you your gun. He is true to his word. Or, if Ruby dies, you can take her gun.
I could have sworn there was a gun under the business building as well.
There is, but that is a, like, old sniper.
Oh.
And that's actually one of the pieces of evidence you can be like, hey, so you said that she would need a sniper.
Right,
well,
yeah.
But you cannot use that as a weapon.
Okay.
There are also, I think, only, like, two, maybe three bullets you can have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are literally two bullets in your gun.
Yeah.
Which is both... like really interesting. Like there's an entire section in the menu for number of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
But also I think that's like a really interesting way of like emphasizing the weight of one bullet.
Yeah.
But so yeah, the tribunal happens. A number of people die. It's kind of, you know, by the time you wake up, because you probably got shot, you can, like, dodge one bullet, and then you would have to dodge another.
I think you always get shot.
Possibly, yeah.
And you always wake up a little later.
Yeah. And usually you will have Kim on your side as well.
Usually.
Usually. But, essentially, you get kind of your little post-tribunal recap with Kim, or, if Kim got shot, Kuno. Mm-hmm. Don't worry, Kim doesn't die either way. I actually ended up with Kuno.
Mm-hmm.
I specifically chose... like, I failed the Kim one because I was like, I want to see what happens with Kuno.
Wow.
Which is why I say I got the worst ending, too, because yeah. I was completely unprepared. Mostly Hardy Boys died. There were, like, two of them left.
Mm-hmm.
It was literally the worst ending.
So I felt bad because Hardy himself died during my first attempt.
Yeah.
And, like, a few other people died as well from the Hardy Boys. And I was like, I feel guilty now. So I went back. This is one of two things I saved Scum for.
Yeah.
You know, three things. First one was to not have to be racist so I could punch Measurehead in the nose.
Nice.
Second one was the ice cream machine. The third one was not letting Hardy or Kim get shot.
Nice, nice.
And by the end, I had like the minimum number of casualties. And I was like, whew, I feel better about this.
In my opinion, personally, I think essentially the best ending is Hardy lives and Elizabeth lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like other people will ultimately still die, but I think that like essentially Hardy being alive and Elizabeth being alive are kind of the like things on the future might be okay kind of ending.
It's the only named characters can live sort of thing.
Yeah,
like, oh yeah, let all the NPCs die.
Although, to be fair, all of the Hardy Boys are unique in their own way. Yeah. And are named people.
Yeah, I know.
But
I think, yeah, just the one that is meant to die is like the old and frail one.
Yeah, it's like the old and frail one, and I think the fat one.
Not sure.
I think he dies no matter what. I'm not sure.
But anyways,
now we get to post-Tribunal. Tribunal is the climax of the game because it's the one where presumably the most characters that you're personally involved with can die.
It's definitely like the most action point of the game. I don't know if it's the climax though.
That's fair. The denouement, as it were, does also have its own climax. But it is the sort of action climax of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there's literally only one moment is also just perfect. So once you wake up, let's assume you have Kim, but like, you know, we're going to assume you probably have Kim. He gives you the laydown on what happened. And essentially at this point, either A, you have checked off basically every other thing on the list, so the only option left would be the sniper shot from the like random island, or B, if you let Clausia off with no like penalty, I think maybe also if you like essentially write her up to like, you know, come back in multiple months, she, as a means of thanking you, ties like a string of the trajectory that the bullet took, and she bounces. She skips town right after, like, I think right before or right after the Tribunal.
Yeah.
And so your real only option at this point is just, well, let's go and check out that island. That's kind of the only that's the last thing we have.
Mm-hmm. So you go to the fishing village, you grab a boat, and you sail over to the island. This place is really cool. It's this old, like, fortress with machines and generators and things. You take a nap there, and it leads to this really interesting dream sequence where, for one thing, we haven't actually said the main character's name.
Yes.
I think we're far enough into spoilers that we can name him.
So, your name is Harry Dubois.
Harry Dubois.
Or, Raphael Alphonse, LaCroix. I don't remember what the last one is. But so, your name is Harry Dubois.
Yeah. And in this dream sequence, you actually get a little bit of information about Harry's ex, Dora Ingerland.
Yes.
This is sort of a specter that has loomed over the unconscious portions of the game. That Harry had a girlfriend, no longer has a girlfriend, most likely due to his own actions.
Yeah.
Of being kind of a piece of shit. And that sort of guilt hangs over Harry. That, like, his drunkenness and drug use and all his like anger problems and everything ultimately led to him losing the person who made him complete, I guess, his only good half.
Yeah, this is actually also interesting. So when you visit her, you don't get her name immediately. She actually appears as a vision of Dolores Day.
Yeah,
which is really fun and cool and interesting.
I don't remember if we talked about Dolores Day in the last episode.
We kind of did.
And how Dolores may be pale touched and may have been the first person to be pale touched, or may have come from the pale, or she could be an alien or something.
Yeah, she is a central figure. She is like the religious figure.
She's like Mary and Jesus.
Yeah.
Mises.
She's a figure for like the progress of humanity and also like a mass murderer. Super fucking interesting. I love it.
She's like Mary and Jesus and Winston Churchill.
Yes. But when you talk to her, when you talk to Dora, the game basically, like, you have broken up with her, or she has broken up with you, but the game will kind of, like, depending on your actions, it will, like, say different things of why she broke up with you. Obviously, if you have been doing a lot of drugs and a lot of drinking, she will bring that up. She actually brings up, like, if you've been, like, a communist and or if you've been really poor, she will bring up, like, you know, we can't keep living like this. You know, we have no money. Like, you know, she brings up as well that, like, you constantly talk as though there's like a million people in your head,
mm-hmm.
which is also like, you know, a little ableist of her, but also like fair considering the characterization we get of Harry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like it is a foregone conclusion that she has broken up with you, but what those specific reasons are is really tailored to who you as a character are.
Which is fun.
Yes.
I love it when games do that.
Yeah. The most interesting thing about Harry is that in finding out who Harry is, you also find out who Harry was.
Yeah.
Like, it isn't... Your past is not like this, you know, this non-existent thing and now is all that matters. Like, you are in playing Harry, you are basically determining who he was like beforehand.
Yeah, it's a weird sort of like, it feels almost like time traveling.
Yeah.
Like you are determining the past by your actions in the present. And that's ultimately just a game system. You know, time doesn't exist in that regard in video games. It can work backwards if it wants.
Yeah.
He never runs out of go back in time potion, but like it ends up making a character that is more immersive in that like he's not doing things you didn't do with him.
Yeah.
But also he did do things you didn't do. But like for example, you know, he drove his cop car off a bridge and into the water.
Yeah.
You know, there's a limit to kind of how much Harry actually does that is based on your own actions and how much of it is stuff he did. I feel like, so I wanted to make this point with addiction, and then I forgot about it, and then I remembered. So much of the game is you feeling unjustly targeted before realizing that people have very good reason not to trust you and to dislike you.
Yeah.
Like, everyone hates you, not in the sense that, like, you're just annoying and they hate you for no reason. They have past experience with you, and you're... attempts to seem like a nice person aren't going to fix that. It's interesting because like I think that's sort of a big point of the message, or not the message, but sort of the themes of the game is this sense of like the weight of the past weighing on the present.
Yeah,
it's like you kind of have to do reparations for being Harry, you know, the bullet holes in Revachol, in Martinez, are also, like, you also leave scars there.
Yeah.
Those are scars that the military has fought, but, like, you left tire tracks, you left a broken police car in the ocean. Like, you have done harm to the city, and you don't realize that, but you are still held to Harry's actions.
Yeah.
Harry's recovery is... Like essentially the framing is that Harry doing a complete blackout was what he needed to wipe his own slate and break from his routines and his self-destructiveness.
Yeah.
And so having amnesia is not just a way for the player to get exposition that the character should have known. It is central to the idea of like being able to break out of the cycle of alcoholism and, you know, drug abuse and really trying to improve. That like honest improvement does not happen overnight, and it does not happen through platitudes. It happens through actions, and whether or not that is improvement to yourself or to a country is the same.
Yeah. I'm going to, you know what, I'm actually going to save this for kind of like the last discussion we have. But I have a view on morality that fits this game very well. But
okay,
before we get to that.
Kind of tipping your fedora there. I do though want to say that so Harry has delusions of grandeur, and it's fun to play into those. But one of those is that he feels he is chosen by Dolores Day for some reason. That might actually be true is the thing.
Yeah.
Like in the Dolorosian church, there's this huge stained glass like image of Dolores Day, and you can go up to it and have what seems to be a conversation with her directly, or like some divine messaging. And it could very well be, given these somewhat supernatural elements, that Harry has some greater role in this. But also the fact that Dora Ingerland appears as Dolores Day feels like this is part of his guilt from his past relationship.
Yeah.
That he feels he has to atone to Dolores Day because he can't atone to Dora.
Yeah. It's... Harry is such a fucking cool and interesting central figure, and I love it. let's explain the actual murder real quick.
Yeah. So there's just this guy.
There's this guy. It's the last Kaminard.
Mm-hmm.
He is basically an old soldier. He was in like the communist revolution, like the one that happened, you know, like 60 or whatever years ago. And when the rest of the world went on without him, he just lived on this island. Yeah. And
when Revachol surrendered, he did not surrender. He remained on the island living by himself.
Yeah.
The AWOL deserter.
Yeah. And like he essentially just sort of spends his entire days just looking at the city as it grows, as it develops, as it crumbles again, as, you know, people go on with their lives. And he just sort of seethes.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the murder itself happened because he has this weird psychosexual obsession with Clausia.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, when he sees the brute with Clausia, he gets like, while he gives an explanation that is sort of more, a little more sympathetic to himself, it's clear that he has this like weird sense of projected jealousy.
He's a bit of a stalker.
Yeah, he is a bad communist, but also he's so damnably interesting because like, he makes a lot of, like, when you talk communism with him, he also kind of essentially makes a point that I can't even exactly refute, which is basically just sort of like, he hates everyone, even and especially you if you're a communist, because his immediate answer is like, you're a cop, you're part of the cog. Like, if you are a true communist, you, like, we should all be out there, you know, actively fighting the revolution again. And he himself is just sitting on this island and not doing that. But like,
yeah.
He kind of admits that that is basically a sin on his part.
Mm-hmm.
Like he has been so chewed up and defeated by the fact that the revolution failed that like he basically has sort of abandoned anything and everything else that he just sort of exists to waste away. And the one time that he had like enough emotion to really care was when he pulled the trigger.
But again, he is a symbol of like a bad communist too. Like,
yeah.
He is unacting. He does not interact with the community. He does not care about the people in Martinez still. He doesn't care about the working class there.
Yeah.
He only cared that they lost before, and the fact that the revolution failed means that everybody failed him, whereas, like, he is also not doing anything to help anyone else. His calls for revolution, again, are short-sighted, and like you said, he's not really fighting as well. It's another all-or-nothing of, like, either we revolt or we do nothing.
Yeah.
Either there's complete system change or, you know, we're not voting because the only thing that matters is system change.
Yeah.
I get very pissed about this because voting matters to people like me who are both gender nonconforming and disabled. Thank you very much. And so, like, it still is a condemnation of a real type of person who might not have a sniper rifle, but might share his sentiments of Viva la Revolution.
Yeah.
His isolation has not helped his rage, and it has definitely not helped the cause of communism.
Yeah, I just sort of wanted to say that, like, this is a game made by communists, and so a lot of its specific pointed criticisms are at communists. And so I think you brought up last time that, like, this idea of, you know, a communism that sees, like, psychic progress as real progress, of, like, if you believe hard enough, it will just work, is like a wonderful, is a wonderful criticism of sort of like Twitter activism. I think this is kind of like a like lefty pole criticism of like people who are, you know, gung ho about revolution and gung ho about, you know, we're gonna rise up and the working class will seize the means of production, but they are ultimately just as culpable as those who, you know, only care about things when Twitter decides that it's time to care about them. Like, they are just as culpable to this feeling of, you know, we can't do anything, so let's just not do anything. And it's unhealthy, and it's, you know, it's a cycle of rage, and it's a cycle of, you know, not getting better, and just like the world is out there passing you by and you're just sitting here angry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do something.
Do just volunteer, fucking participate in elections, because even though it seems impossible and gerrymandering is a thing, fucking, it still affects things.
Yeah, it's...
I live in Missouri.
Yeah, no, yeah, we live in Missouri. We live in St. Louis, the only blue section. Well,
okay, there's two tiny blue dots and then a huge sea of red in the middle.
Yeah.
It's St. Louis and Casey. Come on.
Fair enough.
Give some pointers to Casey.
I will give some pointers to Casey.
And then like a little bit in Columbia. Fucking Mizzou ass.
It's again, really pointed satire, really pointed. And again, I also can't help but draw parallels between him and like leftist misogynists.
Mm-hmm.
I think this game does women really well. Insert joke. Because, like, Clausia, like, for example, Clausia is definitely lying. Clausia is lying multiple times. And there's even a really interesting little bit where if you walk away, like, Guts will tell you, hey, you know how you're listening to everyone else? And they're saying, you know, oh, whatever. You shouldn't be listening to them because they're all lying to you. Because you're blinded by this woman. And, like... It's interesting because on one hand, she is. She kind of is just lying to you. But on the other hand, like, this idea that you should then inherently distrust everything else and trust your gut that she's wrong is sort of like a really, like, it feels like a specific pointed take on, like, you know, internalized misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
Of like, you know, oh, don't listen to everything else. Listen to your gut that says that this woman's a bitch.
Yeah. Yeah, there's... I want to go back, though, to just the fact that this island has nobody else on it.
Yes.
The guy barely even acknowledges you and Kim until you get right behind him. I think, talked earlier about how we keep going all over the place in this discussion because it's a city. You get lost in a city. There is nothing else to talk about with this guy. For the rest of the game, that is an entire city. This one island is such an outlier. It's a miracle that he lives at all because he's so disconnected. The rest of the game takes so many opportunities to show how the city and the country are one organism, and this guy is outside of it. I think that's such an interesting parallel that should tell you, like, there is a problem here. Isolation is not helping. You know, maybe the city does have fascists. That is a problem, but, like, it has a lot of other good people in it. Whereas this guy by himself is just getting more angry.
Yeah. In condemning the city, in deciding that the city is not worth your time, you also condemn those who ultimately are worth your time. And yeah, that's not the way to do it.
That's not communism.
Yeah.
Also, did you get the Insulindian phasmid?
So I did. I did get the Insulindian phasmid. This is sort of the like... really weird 11th hour twist.
Yeah.
Is that the Insulindian phasmid is correct.
It's real.
It's just there.
You get stick bugged.
You get stick bugged.
Before get stick bugged was a meme, you get stick bugged in this game.
It's so good. Now, if you're with Kuno, you unfortunately cannot talk to it.
I talk to it.
But if you're with Kim, you can talk to it. And, oh man, I love bookends. Because... If you talk to it, one of the conversations you can have is sort of like, so like, you know, what's your deal? What do you do? And it basically just like, I mean, you know, I go around, I eat, I poop when I need to, you know, I'm an animal. And your options are, that sounds like a terrible life, or you're the animal I wish I was, which is such a potent, perfect... The beginning of the game is literally you saying, I don't want to be this kind of animal anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the you know, the this 11th hour twist is sort of like your ultimate real, not test, but like basically, you know, what is your view on this at the end? It's like, is the life of, you know, a random animal truly better than what you just experienced, no matter how good or bad?
Yeah. Fucking Insulindian phasmid. Also, if one of the first people you talk to is in the Whirling in Rags is like, you know, there's Clausia, there's the owner of the Whirling in Rags, Gart. and then there is the cryptozoologist woman.
The wife of the cryptozoologist. She's so cute and wonderful.
What's her name? Lena.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if one of the other first people you talk to is Lena, that's another bookend of, like, and then there's just the bit of, like, the guy who so desperately searched for the Insulindian phasmid didn't find it.
Yeah.
But here you are, this asshole.
This random asshole, yeah.
Coming face to face. This is why, like, the stuff with Dolores is so interesting and the Pale is so interesting, because every time you think the game is being purely metaphor in its representation of the supernatural, it throws this shit in.
Yeah, yeah. It's, oh, I love it. I love it. It's so good.
There's just a little bit of mystery. Maybe magic communism is real.
So that is the ending of the mystery, but it is not the ending of the game. The ending of the game is essentially a tribunal on Harry.
Yeah. So there's a few characters you meet throughout the game that don't tell you who they are. There's two people in the Whirling in Rags who you see early on, and you can be like, do I know you from somewhere? Yeah. They're like, fuck you.
Yeah, it's on Wednesday. Wednesday is sort of the linchpin moment where the rest of the game opens up, and they arrive on Wednesday. And, like, they are, you the player can pretty easily piece together that, like, these are cops, and more than that, they're also probably the cops from your precinct.
Mm-hmm.
But they just won't fucking talk to you. And Harry, poor fucking Harry, like, has no option to be like, wait, I know you guys.
Yeah.
So at the very end, when you come back from the island, all of the cops are waiting there.
Oh, also, there's a guy who is showing his son the abandoned electronics factory.
Yes.
He's also a cop.
I love him. He's a cinnamon roll.
Yeah.
He's most genuine character in the game.
He's a nice guy just info dumping about his special interest.
Yeah. And this is kind of where, like, this is another point where, like, essentially how you've been playing Harry dictates how Harry has been. Because, like, the question here is basically, like, yeah, you solved the mystery, but, like, can you convince them that you're worth taking back to the precinct at all?
Especially after the shit you pulled 3 to 5 days ago.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, it genuinely is this kind of, like, answering for the rest of your actions in the game. If you've been drinking and, doing drugs, then they bring up that, no, you haven't changed at all. You've been smoking and everything. If you've been doing the side quests, then you can bring up a lot of the side quests and be like, hey, I helped a bunch of teens, you know, create a nightclub. Like,
and get them out of doing drugs.
Yeah, I helped Kuno here. Get away from his shitty family life. Like, I did good work, and the endings are kind of also a little malleable, but essentially it's like the endings are A, you're left in the city. They just sort of like abandon you in the fishing village, where you can just stay. B, you get to leave, but whoever you're with doesn't get to go with you.
Mm-hmm.
And C, you get to leave and whoever you're with comes with you.
Yeah.
In my case, it was Kuno, and at the end it was like, hey, come on, bring the kid. He's got nowhere else to go. And they were like, fine. And he ended up becoming a junior detective, and I got a, like, achievement that 6% of people did, because who the fuck would choose Kuno over Kim?
Yeah, but that's good. You provided a slightly better future for Kuno.
Yeah, yeah. As for Kim, I don't know if there's... I don't actually know the specific game things that you need to do. Like, I don't know that in terms of, like, just pure code. But, like, essentially you have to... I know that if you're a racist, he straight up is like, no, fuck you, you're a fascist.
Yeah.
Which is very fun.
Yeah. Good job, Kim.
Yeah, good job, Kim. But, you know, like, if you're like, a moralist or a communist, then, like, he's a lot more amenable to it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the fact, like, so as a communist, the guy that you mentioned who's just, like, talking to his son about electronics factory, he actually pipes up where it's, like, part of it is kind of putting him on trial where it's, like, why are you such a piece of shit fuck-up? And he literally brings up, he's like, well, I mean, you know, I don't know. Part of it, honestly, is kind of capitalism. And they're like, what the fuck are you talking about? And he's like, well, I mean, think about it. He's been poor all of his life. He's, you know, been in this vicious cycle of poverty. And, you know, that takes its toll on everyone. Everybody, you know, turns to some kind of vice afterwards. All of us are, you know, not exempt from that. So I don't know. I think it's a legitimate thing to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Like, I have to imagine that if you're, you know, a moralist or an ultra-liberal or even a fascist, he kind of brings up a similar point that's, like, specific to your ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many little different dialogue choices in this game. It's impossible to see everything in three playthroughs.
Yes.
I love it. I got the best ending. Kim and I are best buds.
Yes.
He vouched for me really hard. I think this is what makes Harry so interesting, is like Harry's thing is that he gets results in the worst way possible.
But he always gets results.
Yeah. Which is like part of why they assigned him to this case wasn't just because it was a pissing match between stations and they wanted to see who loses faster, but because you're honestly like one of their best at doing these weird cases. And that is just emblematic of like the way the player plays Harry. No matter what, you're going to be doing weird shit, whether it's odd side quests or it's like you have God's like eye for visual calculus, or you can hear the city and it tells you who did it. Like,
so one of my favorite things is that part of Harry's backstory, no matter what, is that he was a gym teacher.
Yeah.
And if Kim is with you, he literally goes, holy shit, that explains so much. That explains why you're always running. That explains like why your biceps are so large. Mm-hmm. And he literally kind of like clears his throat, which is really cute.
Yeah.
Kim is gay and Harry is bi, and I ship them. Anyway, but he's just like, you know, he's like, that explains why, you know, the cardio that you do, like, holy shit.
Your hair while you're into disco.
Yeah.
It's great. So I love that aspect that like Harry is his own character, but he is also a player stand-in in that. You don't really, he's one of those characters where he is written to embody the player, not in that he's a blank slate, which he kind of is, but that his actions represent what a player does in a game.
Yeah.
Like, of course the player wouldn't understand what's going on when they first appear. They would ask weird questions, but then also, like, the player would just do a bunch of side quests even if it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. The game likes to, especially Kim, likes to comment a lot on like things you do in the first day, where like he mentions the Jamrock Shuffle, which is a specific way of detective work where you just kind of open a bunch of crates and just dig out what's in it, which is a funny little lampshade of the players inherently wanting to loot things.
Yeah.
Or like the fact that you probably have auto run on, he jokes about like, God, can you chill with the fucking running? Jesus Christ. We've been running all day.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the game. It's not like a take that necessarily, but the game has interesting ways of like rationalizing player behavior in terms of, but what kind of character would this be?
A wild card cop.
Yeah. That's another thing, is that like the idea of like a wild cop who doesn't play by the rules but gets results, this is such a great little examination of that, of like, okay, what if, you know, Dirty Harry was a real cop?
You're like a murder hobo in a game without murder.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, the D&D player who will interrogate every NPC as if they're the big bad evil guy.
Yeah. It's perfect of like, you know, what if the player character was a real guy you had to fucking deal with?
Yeah. I think we're nearing the end. I want to just throw out a few small things we didn't touch on.
Go ahead.
One, there's so many little hidden passages in the city, like the underground tunnels, the side entrance into the docks that you go on top of Kuno's shack. It's like, it is a city that is kind of labyrinthine, which works really well for like a mystery with all these little bits and pieces and moving parts. But it's also just cool for a video game, but it's also just cool for a location. You know, it's like you're able to explore all the parts of a city that are normally off limits for a person.
Disco Elysium is kind of like the Dark Souls of isometric RPGs.
Also, speaking of this, one of the passageways is a workshop from that has like a dumbwaiter lift from the top floor to the bottom floor. It's the locked room in the Whirling Rags kitchen that you can't get to normally.
Yeah.
And it was a pinball workshop. Pinball was huge. It has references to how pinball was connected to the mob, or at least in terms of people thought it was in real life. Kim is also like a god at pinball,
yeah.
But because he had to infiltrate a pinball ring as part of a job. And so I love how like Harry is the wild card that gets results. Kim is the meticulous, optimal, like person for the job because he commits to it so hard.
Kim is like a skill monkey.
Yeah.
And I love him.
You can play a pinball table. And I failed the final check.
Oh,
I got to the very end of it and I failed the final check. I want to restart a playthrough just to optimize the pinball game. Speaking of checks, by the way, I think there's a check that's impossible to beat, as in literally impossible.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Which is the weird like bunker door on the peninsula.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the final, so like above north of the fishing village, there's like an old boardwalk. And past that is one of the final places to put one of the, like, phasmid traps. But also on the way between the church and that final tip of the peninsula, there's just this bunker? Like a steel door?
Yeah.
I don't think you can open it.
Like, yeah, I know that most of the things you can pry open with the crowbar, like, essentially the crowbar gives you plus 10 and it's, like, literally impossible otherwise. But... yeah, I genuinely don't remember, like, I remember trying to open it and not being able to. I don't remember ever seeing anyone reference anything about what happens when you open it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, it's,
Yeah, I love all the weird business ventures from the past. The business tower is filled with these old things, like... There's obviously the game company. There's like a clothing manufacturer who's one of the mannequins is supposedly haunted. The bookstore owner is like, there's a ghost back there. You shouldn't go there.
Yeah. Yeah. The business owner, I love her because she's like a new age, like, you know, spectral sort
Snape
of like
wife.
Yeah. She's a... yeah. She's like, you know, she believes in the paranormal and stuff. And she's like, they say this building is haunted. It causes all the things to close down. And, like, in reality, which you basically end up finding out, it's just like, no, this is how businesses go. But when you talk to her, the game has a lot of fun with, like, essentially what you think is the correct option versus what is the actual option.
Mm-hmm.
And with her, if you just say, I'm sorry, but businesses sometimes fail, she's like, no, that can't possibly be it. But if you say, like, ah, you see, I, as a ghost expert, can tell you this is actually a third unrelated thing. She goes, oh, yes, I've heard of this, of course. Like, you know, yes, it's a tertiary thing.
Tertiary.
This episode is now cursed, of course.
Yep.
But she's like, you know, oh, yes, of course, I've heard about this. Thank you for finding it out, which is a fun little linguistic game of just like, you know, like. She expects an answer that's paranormal, so you have to just sort of speak her language to mm-hmm. really put her at ease.
There's this weird game of chicken where, like, there's a shelf with all these paranormal books on it, but she doesn't want you to go and look at that shelf of books.
Yeah.
Also, she's kind of abusing her daughter.
Yeah, yeah. It's... like, what the first conversation you can have with her is like, you know, she's like, oh, good. Did my daughter mention that we have, you know, X, Y, and Z books? And you're like, yes. And she's like, on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate my daughter's experience? And you could be like, I'm not going to rate it. She's a kid.
Yeah. She's employing her daughter in the freezing cold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, character I do like, though, is not Renee, but the other guy he plays Bool with.
Yes.
Is cool. He's like an old teacher. He like works at the community center. He's cool.
He's wonderful.
He's cool. He eats a sandwich. He's cool.
I also love the like teenager who's working at the random chain.
Oh yeah.
Who, like, you can actually get some pretty good information over the world by like talking to her, and she basically is sort of like, oh wait, is this like a test? Or okay, yeah, no, I know this. So like Revachol, that's where we are. You know, it was founded in blah blah blah. Really cute, love her. Okay, so I have this view on morality.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's the correct one. I'm not even saying it's necessarily mine, but it's one that I think about a lot, which is that people like to think of morality as, in general, black and white, but also people really like to think of it as a numbers game. And I mean this in very broad fucking strokes. So, like, people like to, you know, think that, you know, you have, you know, some bad that you've done, you have some good that you've done, and it's a numbers game of, you know, oh, if I do something good enough, then whatever bad I've done doesn't matter. Or there are also people who say, you know, well, you know, if you've done this much bad, then it doesn't matter what good you've done.
People have Peter Molyneux.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a Peter Molyneux game.
Like a Peter Molyneux game.
In this game, you can be good or evil.
And, you know, there's also people who will just abandon everything outright and say, it's gray, you know. There's all kinds, all fucking morality, and all people have been discussing this for fucking centuries. We're not going to solve it on this podcast. I would like to offer that my personal view, or the view that I have generally been workshopping, is that realistically, your life is sort of a line that gets darker and brighter depending on how correct you're acting, quote unquote. And realistically, all that anyone can ever ask of you is that you try and make it a little brighter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I bring this up specifically because, like, with Harry, the past of, you know, Harry is, it's at your fingertips, and you get to find out that Harry was kind of a piece of shit. Like, you know, Harry got a lot of results.
I'd say more than kind of.
Oh, yeah. Like, he got a lot of results. He definitely did some good things, but, like, he did a lot of fucked up shit. And, you know, you can look at that as an outsider, and you can even look at it as Harry himself in his post-amnesia state and be like, wow, I'm a piece of shit. But, like, at the end of it all, the answer is, you know, not necessarily like, well, I'm a piece of shit and I'll never not be. But it's also not, you know, well, if I just do enough good, then it'll outweigh the bad. So realistically, all you can do is just sort of decide that maybe today I'm going to be trying to be a little brighter.
Yeah. You can rehabilitate, but that requires continual effort.
Yeah. It's the old BoJack Horseman quote of, it gets a little easier every day, but you have to do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, you can be a better person despite the things that you have done in your past. You can, you know, try and make it a zero-sum game, but at the end of it, all you can really do, just like the most moral act you can do, is wake up and say, I'm going to try and be a little better.
We should make our podcast better.
We should make our podcast
better. We went for a very long time. I wish one of these days we'll wake up and be like, we'll do an episode under 50 minutes.
Yeah. One of these days we'll wake up and be like, you know what? Our limit is going to be exactly, you know, 45 minutes and not a second longer. But unfortunately, we don't live in that timeline. We live in this one.
Please play Disco Elysium. We only touched on the surface of so much. It's so good. There's so much to it.
Yes. Now, I will say, as much as we've said this, I believe, see if you can try to find a way to play it without purchasing it.
Yeah.
I believe that the ongoing disputes are in fact still ongoing. And I believe that the publisher, or I do not know a lot about the situation that happened, but I do know that essentially right now the money would go to hands that it shouldn't have it.
It's a very muddled situation.
Yeah. So if you can borrow it from somebody, if you've already purchased it and just wanted a kick to play it, my God, still play it. It's there's so much we haven't covered. It's so good.
But for now, thank you for listening. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a comment, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what we should check out or what we should cover in the future, or which is things we might like. You can follow us on Twitter at NetSurferPro, where we tweet out teasers of upcoming episodes. We should have some teasers coming up with some of our planned programming for April.
Yes.
You can follow me on Twitter at Twakaroo, TWAKAROO. I tweet what I'm working on, what sort of projects I've got, any sort of funny tweets I have in mind, and also when I go live on my stream at twitch.tv/twak, where I stream on most weekdays, usually sometime after noon or 1 p.m. Central Time. I stream competitive games, roguelites, some weird or interesting single-player games. I recently finished Hi-Fi Rush on stream. I've been playing a bit of the puzzle game Bonfire Peaks, a lot of Hitman Freelancer mode, playing a bit of Civilization 6. So if any of those are interesting, check that out. And it's always a good time.
And as for myself, you can find me on Twitter and on TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWLS0N. I post my hot takes on Twitter. And on TikTok, I've been trying to do a lot of sort of, you know, like video gamey and talking about things I likey stuff. Also a lot of leftist stuff. But I've been trying to get the hashtag NetServerPro up and running. You can also find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, but why follow me there when you can follow me on twitch.tv/machinegunvampire, where I actually have been streaming a bit more recently, doing things like you said, Civ 6. I've been also thinking of doing a Crusader Kings campaign there, because Crusader Kings is sort of eating up my time. I might even stream Final Fantasy 14 one of these days. That'd be the day, though. Lord knows I'd have to be like, hey, don't watch this if you haven't played Shadowrun. Famously, Shadowrun is the expansion in Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah, it's really weird how they added all those, like, guns and computer tech, and you can, like, jack in and netrun.
Papalimo kicks in a door, and he's like, hey, we invented fucking netrunning, bitch.
Hack into the mainframe now. You better do it. Or else I'm going to change voices again.
Thank you very much for listening. This has been NetSurfer Pro. Go play Disco Elysium.
And if you have a dog, pet your dog.
Pet the dog.
See ya.